you should feel free, as always, to have yourselves muted if you prefer. You're welcome not to as well, so we can have a conversation if you have any questions or observations or contributions. What we'll do is, for Parasha Under Pressure, as always, I'll give a rough overview of the contents of the parasha, and then we'll turn to a specific pasuk or a specific scene, and I'll share my screen with you toward the end. So in many ways, this is a parsha of two topics, radically disconnected on the surface, intertwined on a more profound level, and in an experiential level, as readers, as practicing Jews, they could not be more different, these two topics. On the one hand, there are a lot of details about the priestly life, about Kohanim, and on the other, there's a lot of details about national life, about the Chagim. And that's a rough distinction in the middle of this week's parasha, where we have all the Chagim that we all participate in, summarized in detail and obligated toward the end. At the beginning, a lot of details that are incredibly specific to Kohanim writ large, to the Kohen Gadol as well. And that's where it begins. It begins, v'daber Hashem Moshe l'emor, as always, and Moshe is told to tell Aaron and the Kohanim some key details about the obligations of being a priest, which relate to impurity. The people for whom a Kohen can become Tame. Any Kohanim that I can see on the screen here, raise your hand. I can only see about 20 of you at once, so I can't tell. All right, raise your voice.
Present.
Present. Oh, so present. You're a Kohen?
No, I think so. Chip Cone.
Oh, that was Chip? Oh, Chip. Well, yes, your name's a giveaway there. Thank you. Excellent. And I'm just looking through the names here, actually. I see a lot of people have called in who I can't see, but it's lovely to see your names. And I'd love to know how you're all doing. If I haven't spoken to you recently, it's lovely to see your names. Okay, so we've got some Kohanim here. My wife, Miriam, is a Bat Kohen, so her whole family are Kohanim. That's my closest connection to Kohanim. There you go. Debbie's also a Bat Kohen. And there are distinct laws. My in-laws can't go into cemeteries. Rabbi Taub from Holliswood is a Kohen. And when I arrived here, he said, Rabbi, I've got good news and bad news. And among the things was, he says, look, I'm quite limited in what I can do pastorally within a cemetery. And I may be calling on you for assistance. And thank God that call has not come thus far. But there are limitations. In fact, my wife's family, not only they're Kohanim, they are a lot of them rabbis that went into rabbinic professions. You may know Avi Weiss, my wife's grandfather, Mordechai Weiss, his brother, went into the rabbinate, and it's very limited when you're a Kohen. In fact, one of her uncles, Ari Weiss, who was a rabbi in West Hartford, Connecticut, in the shul where he was the rabbi, they did a lot of the eulogies within the shul sanctuary. And there was a special window by the side of the Aron Kodesh, which opened outwards into a platform. And they would often have a casket placed on that platform. So it was, you could see it, but it was outside the room. They had a Kohen who was a rabbi for a long time, and they designed it so he could be in the room to give eulogies at the same time. So Kohanim are very limited in that way. There is a question, if a young lady is pregnant and she doesn't know it's a boy or girl, can she go to a cemetery when there's a boy possibly within her? That's a separate conversation, but there are questions all around this. And what it comes down to is that there are limits for a priest. It then goes on from the impurity rules, and that's seven exceptions for the Kohen, which includes brothers, sisters, parents, children, spouse, does not apply to the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol has an extreme prohibition on coming in contact with those who are deceased, with those who have passed. And there are obligations around who they can marry. Some of you may know of historical situations where there are people who are Kohanim who later in life do some research and discover that they were not really Kohanim, or, the history is fuzzled, and then they marry a divorcee. This has happened a couple of times in rabbinic history that I know of, where a rabbi later in life has wanted to either remarry or get married late in life, and they've met someone as a divorcee, and as a Kohen, you can't marry a divorcee. And they've done some genealogical research, and I'm holding back from inserting a humor or sarcasm here because I don't know circumstances in these cases. It's often reported in a sarcastic way, like, oh, and they discovered they weren't really a Cohen. How convenient. They were lucky enough not to have Chip's last name, but figured out a way. But I'm not in people's shoes. I'm not in people's heads. But the limitations are real. And it's complicated. We then get to the details after those restrictions of purity and marital laws. There are complications of what is called a mum. Forgive me for this, I meant to say at the beginning, I want to reiterate Mazel Tov wishes to the Levine family. You can see Ari and Ariella there. Ayal leaned beautifully this morning, and Michal gave him a beautiful kiss right at the end. It was lovely to hear, lovely to watch. And it just reminded me, I had to hold myself back this parasha when we're talking about korbanot, and we talk about mums all the time. In England, the pronunciation of Hebrew was a mum, and cows wouldn't say that. But here, you tend to say mum, and it just, you've got to hold yourself back from making jokes about cows with mums. But either way, there are mumim to animals, and there are mumim to kohanim. And there's a discussion about how many lefties here. Raise your hand, raise your voice. But a few lefties. There you go. Ari's a good one. I see Ruthie too. Yeah, Miriam's a lefty. We don't know about the kids. I don't know what age you figure out what hand they like using. In the meantime, they throw with both quite nicely. So that's not baseballs. That's just anything. Left-handedness is discussed in the literature as whether that's officially considered a mum. This is in many ways complicated too, because laws on marriage, one can elaborate, give interpretation, laws on impurity, one can fill in, but the mum, that it seems to be incredibly discriminatory, that somebody who's got a disability, we say you can't partake in ritual life. You have no role on the center stage of the temple because you have, I mean, left-handed, it's hard to say that that's a disability. In the old days, in many ways, it was considered a disability. I don't know how many of your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, they used to, at least in England, tell us stories that if a kid started writing with the left hand, the teacher would get out a ruler and hit the hand until they started writing with the right hand. Because it was, you're pointing at Ruthie, did you get hit in the hand? No, you hit other people in the hand, great. Forgive me, I have to deal with that phone later. So left-handedness, again, it feels less discriminatory in a profoundly troubling sense. It's kind of somewhat jokey to say, oh, you're a lefty. By the way, if it makes you feel better for the lefties out there, apparently contemporary research suggests that left-handed indicates more creative, more artistic, more articulate. I stumbled over that. Yes, I'm right-handed. It's a blessing in many ways. There's a discussion about whether wearing what we call glasses or spectacles, or as you call them, glasses, whether that's considered a mum. Could you not be a Kohen if you had to wear glasses? It's a question that the literature actually discusses. If I'm wearing glasses, can I say Kiddush Levana? Because I'm not really seeing the moon. Because if I took my glasses off, I don't know how many of you bespectacled people feel how you see without them. But if I take mine off, I imagine I can't see the screen very well. So there would be a question about that. Did someone raise a hand? I have a raised hand here. Chip? No. Okay. But there is a discussion about disability being discriminated against in the Mikdash. And the same discussion applies to Birchat Kohanim, about whether someone with a mum who would be deemed excluded from the Kohanim and the Bet Mikdash is allowed to do Birchat Kohanim. It struck me that possibly one can, again, when it comes to Jewish life and Jewish law, the bottom line is it doesn't have to be comprehensible for us to observe. We live in a constant state of submission, and patience. And when we talk about living a life of Avodat Hashem, that doesn't just mean I've got my clear instructions and I feel empowered and driven. It sometimes means Avodah is like an Eved. At the end of the day, we live a prescribed life based on faith and tradition, given the tools that we are to make it adaptable and understandable. But it could be that we don't understand something. I can't sit down with a straight face and explain to a young man who's a Kohen who falls in love with a divorcee why it's prohibited. It's difficult to make an argument in this day and age. It's just that's the rules. That's the law. However, if one can find meaning, one should try to lend meaning to these rules. And the discrimination, let's call it, the exclusion, more fairly, of those who have a mum from ritual life and from Birchat Kohanim could be explained in that those who have a mum, which I guess I should give a translation to, disability is probably not the right word, because there are specific rules about what's considered a mum. Someone who's missing a limb, someone who is blind in one eye, someone who's blind, someone who can't hear. There's some disability. And the exclusion could be on the basis, not that they're not good enough, but actually they have too much of a personal story in the sense that to be a priest is to be rid of one's personality. You are a pivot, a hinge. You are an inflection point for us to connect with God. Essentially, to be a Kohen, you're doing robotic service. You're not meant to inject your personhood into my relationship with God. I need a medium so that I'm not in direct contact as a Yisrael. I come to the Beit Mikdash and I need a mechanic to fulfill my obligation. And if you come to me and I see that you have a disability, my sympathies, my interest, my curiosity, my attention is engaged in a way that distracts from my relationship with God. And actually, the disability adds personality to the encounter. And if you stand up to do Birchat Kohanim, and my interest is on you as a human being, how can I help? What is your story? How have you persevered? I have admiration for you. It distracts from what is essentially meant to be an invisible conveyance of divinity. I don't know if that helps some of you identify with those rules, but if it does, that's helpful. So that's the moment. We then get to the rules of the Kohanim. They get some benefits as well. Not only do they have these restrictions, they can eat truma that nobody else can eat. And I've taken that off the menu for Miriam, and Jerry's done that to Debbie. You can't have truma if you marry Yisrael. You're not missing out in this day and age too much. And you should know, for those bat Kohanim who married Yisrael, for a little side business, you can, for many views, still take money for Pidyon HaBen if the case should require it. So you can still do that. You haven't lost your priestliness, Kohanic nature, all in all. I see we have some famous lefties. Someone just posted Albert Einstein was a lefty. I guess it's not a creative artistically only, but also scientifically. I'm not seeing all the chat. It's just flicking up. So I'll read what I can. That is the shifting point where we go from the Kohanim and we turn to Korbanot, and then we get from Korbanot into the Chagim. And when it comes to Korbanot, there are a couple of things worth noting. Firstly, we have some of the rules around Shechita. And Shechita is one of the cases that is employed as an example why there must have been a oral tradition that accompanied the Torah. There must have been a transmission of a Kadosh Baruch Hu saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, take down these words and let me tell you the traditions that go with it. It must be, people suggest, from the text that tells you how to do Shechita, that there is an accompanying tradition. It can't just be the text on its own. How do I know? Because anyone here ever done Shechita? Excellent. Anyone here? Yaakov's kind of humming and hawing. You did it badly. What happened? You're muted. Okay. You're not sure if you did Shechita. Okay. Anyone here seen Shechita? Excellent. Jesse seen it. Linda seen it. Excellent. I had Asha seen it. I had the opportunity. I think Shechita. I may have mentioned once before.
Shechita that I made was not kosher.
Say again.
The shechita that I made was not kosher.
Oh, so you, right. So you did shkita, it just didn't work. Okay. You were training or you tripped? What happened?
Well, let's say, it was not animal.
It was not an animal. Okay, we'll leave the story there. I don't know how, I'm not sure where that story is going to go, but it does remind me of another story.
Casualty of war.
Sorry?
Casualty of war.
Casualty. Yeah. Oh, I see. Thank you. Okay. So that's now gone from humorous to a very dark place. I see. So it wasn't even an attempt at Shkita, but you've killed. I see. We had that discussion last week, actually, in the context of Kohanim. When it comes to Birchat Kohanim, we mentioned last week, there seems to be an exclusion of Kohanim who have killed, even if it was a mitzvah. And we discussed that separately. Your story about, or the assumption I had of a Shkita that went wrong, I think I said this a couple months ago, a man, a rabbi, got traveling from Israel to Argentina. This must have been Parashat Vayetze, when we spoke about Gid HaNasheh. Gid HaNasheh, most people in kashrut plants just write off the back half of the animal. We don't do the trabering, the taking out of the veins and the sinews, so you can eat what's it called, that steak at the back?
Filet mignon.
It's the same in normal gullet, because I've no idea.
Sirloin.
Sirloin. Thank you, Jack. Yeah. So in Argentina and South America, they still procure that and they export it. And there was an expert shochet from Israel who was traveling to Argentina to participate in this procedure. And he arrived, and this is the story I'm told, I can't verify. He got to the airport, they went through his luggage, and they said, why do you have 14 incredibly long, sharp knives? And his answer was, I kill for the Jews. That was his answer. So he didn't speak very good Spanish. They didn't speak very good Hebrew. They didn't really speak very good English, as you could hear. So they figured out that they were talking about animals. But yes, there can be a misunderstanding on that level. So Shkita is one of the cases that is employed to suggest the Torah Shebaal Peh, the old tradition, must be evident because there are no details about how to do Shkita in the Torah. The Torah says, you shall do Shkita ka'ashed tzivikticha, as I commanded you. Nowhere in the Torah is there a list of the five requirements for what makes a kosher Shkita. When I was in Gush, they did something called Lamb Day, which they named generously Lamb Day. They had a shochet come in, would teach us the rules of Shkita. There was a lamb. And let's say he didn't see sundown, and they had a barbecue. I mentioned, actually, again, when I brought this up, there were three lambs. They always have three because it doesn't always end up being kosher. And it turns out two of the three lambs or sheep ended up not being glut, meaning there was some scar tissue on some of the lungs. And in America and Israel, most of the Orthodox community only eat glut kosher meat. In England, that is not a standard practice. You want glut. When you go to the butcher, you have to ask, can I have glut kosher? It's not the regular practice. So we had two sheep for all the Brits in Gush, and then one sheep for everybody else. So it ended up being a good night for the Brits. But those rules about glut and about drisa and about shahia and about not pushing, bichika, all these rules are not given in the Torah. It just says, as I commanded you, which is used as evidence there must be an oral tradition alongside. There is a famous, relatively famous rule of sacrificial apparent compassion. Oto ve'et beno. Anyone familiar with what that phrase connotes? Yeah. Oto ve'et beno? That's the end of the pasuk. Excellent.
Same day.
Excellent. So there is a rule. One cannot shecht a mother and a child animal on the same day. Why is that? Anybody know? Any guesses? Why should that be prohibited?
Tzar Balei Chaim.
Compassion.
Tzar Balei Chaim. So Saul has been in contact with Maimonides while we weren't looking with the Rambam. The Rambam says this is complete evidence. that the Torah cares about the pain of animals. The Ramban, Nachmanides says, well, hold on a minute. If the Torah cared deeply about the pain of animals to that extent, what would we be prohibited from doing?
Eating meat.
Vegans.
Shechita, right. Saying don't kill the mother and child on the same day. You know, slaughter the rest of the family, kill the children tomorrow. The Ramban says, Maimonides, you're overplaying the turn of compassion here. But Maimonides feels very strongly here that you don't kill a mother and child on the same day out of compassion to the animals. And I actually mentioned this during Elul in one of our discussions of Tzelem Elokim, the Netflix special called Blackfish. Some of you may have seen, may have you heard of. It's probably still up on Netflix. Blackfish is about the treatment of orca or killer whales in the entertainment industry. And it goes into the emotional intelligence that these creatures clearly have and describe the orcas wailing, forgive the pun, I'm trying to think of another word, but wailing in pain
very punny.
When they are separated from their children. They imagine it's like you've got mice, so you split them up and you move it on. So you've got one whale here, one whale there, and you split them up. And the mother whales cry and screech throughout a night in what the scientists say can only really be explained as grief. And they speak about how the different orca can't communicate with each other. We assume our animals, they just kind of harumph at each other and they squeak, like, and that's it. But actually, there are dialects. And it's like sticking people who speak German and French and Spanish and English and Hebrew in a room and saying, get along, be friends and entertain us. We just can't communicate in any sort of sophisticated way. In the orca whale display the same shifts in culture. They have different languages, different vernacular, different gestures, different cultures. So the Rambam is very sensitive to us treating animals with dignity and respect. Tiger King has apparently been put up on Netflix as well, which is about cruelty to big cats and strangeness among human beings. A friend told me. So you should feel free to look into that. Nachmanides thinks this is strange, and specifically in a religion, in a context where we're speaking about slaughtering animals wholesale as part of our religious service, to speak of the pain of animals being the priority, Nachmanides feels stretches credulity. Of course, there is a prohibition on Tsar Balei Chaim. We are forbidden as people to exploit and pain animals for our entertainment. There's no doubt about that. And Nachmanides doesn't push back on that at all. He doesn't scoff at the pain of animals. He suggests that the animal pain doesn't interfere with our religious life, but it should never be an ambition or an activity or a source of entertainment for us to pain animals. There's a discussion in Jewish literature, in the halachic literature, whether hunting should be permitted. Again, in Jewish life, you can only eat an animal if you shecht it. It is incredibly hard to shecht an animal with a gun from a distance. There's a discussion, actually, about whether if you throw a knife and it happens to shecht an animal, is that shechita kosher? And the bottom line is it probably is. But again, I don't see anyone walking around with a crossbow and a shechita knife trying to do shechita. So hunting would be purely for entertainment or for enjoyment. And there's a discussion about whether that should be permitted or prohibited under halachic life. And everybody in the halachic literature has their own line. Because let me ask you this. Are you allowed to pain animals for medical research? What would be your instinct?
Yes.
Okay, so some of you may disagree, but I only heard yes. Did someone say no?
Sure, why not?
Why not? You've got to make life hard for me. Yes. So it's an interesting discussion. Most halachic views suggest that medical research should absolutely be permitted for human purposes. At the moment, they're doing vaccination research on animals all the time. And they what's so remarkable is they've started doing it in human patients so swiftly as well. But in the halachic literature, Tzar Balei Chaim is clearly prohibited unless there is a human need being served. Medical research, everybody agrees, is a human need. What about my leisure? Is it human need to have leisure?
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, if I'm just being sadistic and I don't even enjoy it, but I just want to shoot an animal in the head because I've got nothing else to do. Let's say everybody agrees that's Tsar Balei Chaim. Kicking a cat on the floor because I'm bored, that's Tsar Balei Chaim. But what about if I get specific pleasure from hunting? Again, some of us, it may feel odd to suggest that we have grown up in a metropolitan area where hunting, we don't even do off spiders in our own home. We stand on chairs and scream and say, help, somebody call the exterminator. But if you're living in a culture where there's a tradition of hunting, it can be very deeply, profoundly meaningful for people to engage in that activity. So is that a human need? And again, in the halakhic literature, there's one figure, medieval Tosafist, who used to own a, what are those birds called that do, falcon, owned a falcon and went hunting. And it was a personal practice. And others said, you're crazy. There's nothing less Jewish than going hunting. And of course, the vociferousness of political debate is not unique to our age. But this is a discussion when it comes to Tsar Balei Chaim. And the Rambam thinks it's important for Otovet Beno. You can't kill a mother and child on the same day. The Rambam thinks it's irrelevant to Tsar Balei Chaim. You're killing an animal because you're doing a korban. So the mother and child shouldn't really come to play. If I'm doing a korban, there's a human need. Perhaps in his mind, again, as a mystic, as a halachist, there's no greater need than serving God in this way. So of course you should kill the mother and child on the same day. From the perspective of the animal thing. So what's the prohibition? That I shouldn't become cruel. That's what Nachmanides says. It's not about the animal's pain. The animal's pain is overridden by the need to serve God in this instance. But I shouldn't become desensitized to mothers and children, whether animals or human. And that's why it's prohibited for Nachmanides, for the Ramban, in one view. You then shift gears, and I realize time is marching on in the middle of the parasha, and we shift towards the description of Shabbat. And I'll just mention at this point, because it's become so pertinent to our time, Shabbat we usually translate just as rest or cessation. Lishbot is just to stop. But Rav Mecklenburg, the Hakatava HaKabbalah, suggests that actually Shabbat, if you look at the root in various places in Tanakh, suggests more along the lines of meditation, not to stop, but to discover, to engage intellectually with something. And Shabbat, he then describes as the prime time, often in academic circles, you have something called a sabbatical. Rabbis, I know, often have sabbaticals. Does anybody else in any other profession have sabbaticals?
Teachers
have sabbaticals. It's basically, we know that teachers and rabbis and professors and academics, when you're teaching around the clock, you very rarely get to research new material because you're preparing and you're grading and you're reading over notes and you're teaching. So they often give you a window of time to look at new material, to refresh your mind, and to turn to new subjects. And his suggestion is that Shabbat is literally that kind of sabbatical. It's not just time to sleep. If academics are given a year off, the assumption of the academic administration is not that they're schluffing for 12 months. The assumption is, yes, you don't have the pressures of classroom teaching, but you're researching, you're publishing, you're doing something new. And that's what his suggestion of Shabbat is. Once a week, we have a sabbatical, which is not just about stopping, but about refreshing our minds, reading something different, trying to discover. That's his suggestion. We then move into Pesach and Shavuot. And I mentioned this morning, after Eyal laid so beautifully, that there is a prohibition ordinarily of chametz getting anywhere near the Mizbeach. You can't have chametz on the Mizbeach. You can't have dvash on the Mizbeach, honey, with one exception, which is noted in the laning that we'll be reading the Shabbos at Eyal laid beautifully this morning, which is on Shavuot. On Shavuot, there is chametz in the Bet Mikdash as part of the Korbanot, which is an exception. And the question is posed why that exception breaks the rule, which basically is two questions. Number one, what's wrong with chametz? Number two, why is Shavuot any different? And there are a number of different readings to this. I can't go through them all if I'm to put a pasuk under pressure, but I'll go with a couple. The Ramban, Nachmanides, suggests that yeast is... Anyone here ever... tasted yeast on its own? Good. It's incredibly sour. Say again?
Marmite, is that like yeast?
Oh, excellent. Do you have Marmite in this country?
I taste it.
Fortunately.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Yes. In England, I think it's Australian originally, I'm not sure. they have Marmite, and their ads, or what we call in England, their adverts were always Marmite, you love it or you hate it. And people bought into that, and people tend to either hate it or love it. I don't know anyone who says about Marmite, I'm neutral. But that was their ad campaign. My sister loved it. I actually don't think I ever tasted it, but I didn't like the smell of it, so that was the end of it. But yes, that is a, I think the main ingredient might be yeast. Very sour, very distinct taste. And the Ramban suggests that it is too concentrated a substance to encapsulate the complexity of human experience. He sees dvash and seor, yeast and honey, as the incarnate sweetness of rachamim and sourness of din. And he says that's just not how we experience life as human beings. We have emotional peaks and troughs that never fully dive, please God, into the depths of sourness, and we never truly achieve the ecstasy that honey comprises. So it's just not part of our religious service. You can't have that. Life is not lived at the extremes, and we leave that out of religious life, with one exception, which is Shavuot. On Shavuot, we have a small window into what it's like to be in contact with divinity. It's the day on which the Torah was given, the day on which the veils of heaven were drawn back. And we have the chametz on the altar representing the din, and we have the bikurim, which have the date honey there as well, to show us the little taste of what it's like to be in touch with the extremes of divine mercy and divine justice. That's his view. There are other views, but we've got to press on, so we'll move on. The parasha then goes through the deeds of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, details what the requirements for olive oil are for the Bet Mikdash, and then we turn to the Lechem Hapanim. What are the Lechem Hapanim in English?
Showbread.
How on earth do you get to Lechem Hapanim to showbread as translation? It's a good question. Panim means face. And really, face bread is an odd translation, and show bread comes from the medieval interpretation from the Rashbam and others, that really it's called lechem apanim because you could see it, the face of it was shown. So show bread is quite an accurate translation of the term. And how often was the lechem apanim replaced?
Once a week, every Shabbos.
Every Shabbos, once a week it was replaced. Now, with modern preservatives, you can have loaves of bread that sometimes are good if you leave it out on a counter for a few days. A week is probably stretching it, even with the most preservatives possible. However, I'm sorry, I was getting distracted by a chat about Vegemite and Marmite. But no problem. So the preservatives won't last a week. But the Lechem Hapanim was changed once a week, and it was deemed a miracle that they were fresh all week, and then the Kohanim ate it Shabbat afternoon, which leads us to the final narrative of the book of Vayikra. And I say final because there have only been two, essentially, the deaths of Nadav and Avihu, and we're now going to have another tragedy, which is the episode of the blasphemer, or the Mekalel, the curser of God, who ends up, we'll see in a minute, we'll look at the text in the 7 minutes that we have. And then before I turn to that, the parsha finishes out with what is called in Latin the Lex Talionis. Anyone know what the Lex Talionis is? I'll give you 15 points if you know what the Lex Talionis is without Googling quickly.
Revenge.
Excellent. Steve wins, 15 points. Lex Talionis is ayin tachad ayin, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, an arm for an arm, a foot for a foot. That is Lex Talionis in Latin. And you know something is important in terms of theology if it's given a Latin name. You've got the Decalogue that's important. You've got Lex Talionis that's important, and others where the four-letter name of God, the Tetragrammaton, all these names, all these Latin terms reflect deep theological debate. And of course, the Lex Talionis, Ein Tachid Ayin, engendered a huge debate about justice, revenge. You're telling me an eye for an eye? Anyone know what Gandhi famously said about an eye for an eye? Probably wasn't him, but he said lots of good things, so people assumed it was him. If we did an eye for an eye, the whole world would be blind. And others have been reported to say that too. And of course, it's an astonishing system of justice, which the sages knew from the start, that the biblical text did not mean an eye for an eye. You literally take out somebody else's eye for an eye, but you take monetary payment for the eye. Now, it's odd again that those rules appear in the midst of this narrative about this blasphemer that we are going to turn to in the 6 minutes that remain. Okay, can you see my screen?
Yes.
Excellent. We are on Parsha Under Pressure, Parsha Emor, for those who are following. And this is a painting by William Blake, a romantic British poet and painter. That's a blasphemer underneath on the floor, and you're surrounded by fellows who are, you probably can't see my face, is right up in the corner, but they're all holding stones about to stone him. And this is the biblical text. V'yetze ben isha yisraelit v'hu ben ish mitzri. There was this son of a Jewish woman who was the son of an Egyptian man. So this is a very intriguing description of a mixed background. V'yinatsu b'machaneh. And there was a fight that ensued in the camp. Ben ha-Yisraelit ve'ish ha-Yisraeli. Between this son of a Jewess and a Jewish man. So we now have the son of a mixed partnership fighting with a Jew in the camp. That's all we're told. We're not given any more details to this fight. Vayikov ben ha-Ashah ha-Yisraelit et Hashem. And the son of the Jewess uttered the name of God. Yaakov literally means, anybody know what? Literal translation?
Pierced,
exactly. One connection is Maccabi. It means like a hammer because you would knock nails into things. Yaakov, there's also other routes that may lead us down an odd path we won't get to. Yaakov and Ishai Yisraelit, with he pierced the name of God. He uttered God's name. The kalal, and he cursed. So all we're told now is two guys, one Jew, one son of a Jew and Egyptian, got into a fight. The son of the Jew and Egyptian said the name of God and cursed out loud. The Aviwa to El Moshe, they took him to Moses, Vashem Imo, and now we're told, by the way, the name of his mother was Shlomit Bat Divri Lamate Dan. Her name was Shlomit, she was the son of Divri, and she was from the tribe of Dan. And they put him in jail, essentially. They incarcerated him to figure out what to do with this blasphemer. Moshe, God said to Moshe, take him out to the outskirts of the camp. All those who heard him curse have to put their hands on his head. And the entire people will now stone him. This is a very graphic scene of what happens to a blasphemer, and the text is shot through with questions. And I've just taken a moment to highlight some of the questions that will arise. He's the son of a Yisraelit and the son of an Egyptian. Why aren't we given a name? That's a question that arises. Who is this Egyptian? Is this guy Jewish or not? If he's Jewish, why do we need to be told who his parenthood is? Who's this Egyptian? Anyone know, according to tradition, who the Egyptian was?
It was the guy who was, wasn't he the Dimitri that was killed?
Correct. Rashi says, and according to tradition, the Mitzri here is the Egyptian that Moses killed. And why did Moses kill that Egyptian? Because he assaulted and raped a Jewess. And this man who's now walking was the result of that assault. So that's tradition. Now, how on earth does tradition get that from this text? All we're told, he was the son of Egyptian. There were a lot of Egyptians around. And one of the ways that tradition came to be was looking at this text. Why is this guy cursing? Why is he getting so angry? He's fighting with another guy. Why is he cursing God? And the Midrash suggests that what they were fighting about was that somebody told this guy how his dad was killed. And they said, do you know how your dad died? You don't know this, but your dad was killed. Guess who killed him? Moshe killed him. And do you know how Moshe killed him? Mm-hmm. Anyone know how Moshe killed the Egyptian?
Hashem.
So the answer is no, none of us were there. And there are different traditions, but a major stream of tradition, exactly as you've said, is that Moshe used the name of God and just said it and the guy died. And that's where the tradition comes from, that this son of an Egyptian starts cursing the name of God. It's not just that he got into a fight and he starts cursing and he just uses God's name like we say, oh, for gosh sake. That's not what happened. He was told how his father died. He told that Moses did it. He told that he used God's name. And he goes, V'yikov, and he curses the name of God and he curses Moses. That's how that tradition comes. That we're told who this Egyptian is. We're told that he went out, B'toch B'nei Yisrael. What is that? Where else would he be? That's a question. What is V'yikov, V'yikalel? What is the difference between those two terms? Why are we told the name of his mother and her parenthood and their tribe? Why is that important? Those are all questions. Another important question would be why everybody who heard the curse has to put their hands on his head, and all these things are left with different answers. The one question that I'll end with, because it's 9:15, is right at the top. I've highlighted in blue now, is the opening word of this episode. Vayetze, and he went out. What's the question?
From where?
From where? What do you mean he went out? We have Vayetze in Parshat Vayetze. At least we know where he was going from. Here we just have Vayetze B'toch B'nei Yisrael. He went out. What on earth does that mean? And oh, forgive me. That leads us, that was just a reference to stoning and blasphemy in Monty Python. But this leads us to Rashi in the remaining moment, who says, Mehechan Yatza, where did he go out from? Say again?
Didn't he come out
from Shemoshin?
Because he was trying to figure out what Shebet he belonged to, and he came out based in, and some story like that, and he was unhappy, and then he cursed.
Excellent. That is Rashi's second answer, which is an answer also to the question, not only by Yetze, but why we're told what tribe he's in. Because this is the first case where we have somebody who's Jewish by matrilineal descent, but doesn't have a tribal identity because he doesn't have a Jewish father. And the question becomes, well, what do I own? This is a question that will be addressed to the Benot Slofchad when we get into Bamidbar. But right now, this is the first test case where he doesn't have tribal inheritance. And he goes to the Beis Din of Moshe, and Moshe says, I'm sorry, you're out. You don't get nothing. And that's when he curses God. That's the second view of Rashi. The first view we'll see here at the top, Aleph Reb Levi says, Me'ola mo yatsa. He went out from his world. That's what it means. Now, what on earth does that mean? He went out from his world. And time is short, so I think we'll finish here. There's obviously a lot more to say, but we'll finish here. I think Me'olamo Yatsa is suggesting something quite pertinent to the way we're living right now. We are all, though we're on our screens, we are living in a bubble. We are living in our own world. And I think we are all wondering about the challenge of when we can come back together, how we can reintegrate. But I think there are a lot of things we're going to have to relearn about social etiquette that we assume comes naturally. We have not been within 6 feet of somebody outside our own home comfortably for nearly 2 months. And I think it will be natural. And we assume we're going to come together and it's going to be just a joy. And please God, there will be huge amounts of joy in coming back together. But I think we should also expect to have a little bit of etiquette roughness about how to converse, how to respect other people's space, to come out me'olamo from our world and expect not to get into a fight and end up cursing is precisely what we want to avoid. And what this young man, the son of an Egyptian, he came out me'olamo. He was living in his own world. He was living in his own tent. And then he came out, and we don't need any more details, Rashi says. We don't need the backdrop of who his father was. We don't need the backdrop of the Beis Din, because to start with, all you need is to enter the world without sensitivity to other people's space and privacy and requirements and needs to get into a fight. And that's precisely what we want to avoid. And that is the final narrative of Vayikra that leads us through the ritual of spiritual life and then sensitizes us at the very end. That we cannot live ba'olamenu. We can't just live in a ritual bubble where we care only for our own sacrifice, for our own ritual, for our own worship, for our own prayer, for our own connection to God. We have to live ba'olamenu together in worlds with each other. And it is my hope that we will be able to do that incredibly soon in ways that are safe and healthy and sensitive. And we should come out not as mekalalim, but as mevarchim. We should bless each other and bless the name of God as well. We are going to turn...